Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Today is Thursday, April 19th. Members, we have one item on our agenda today, and that is we will continue to take public testimony on House File 4289, the Jobs, Energy, Housing Omnibus Bill. So first on the list, I have Chris Kunkel. Chris, are you here? No? Next, I have Cam Witten. And Dominique McQuarrie, you're on deck. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Cam Winton, Director of Energy Policy, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Just wanted to provide a follow-up from the conversations that the committee had been having the other night regarding Xcel Energy's nuclear facilities. The Chamber of Commerce and various members of the Chamber of Commerce did have a series of discussions within themselves and with Xcel Energy. Unfortunately, we're not able to find a mutually agreeable way forward, so the Chamber continues to respectfully oppose the nuclear facilities bill that the committee has considered.
Thank you, Mr. Witten. Next on the list, Dominique McQuarrie, and on deck is Charlie Vanderard. Charlie, are you here? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Dominic McQuarrie, and I'm a public policy analyst with the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation and a representative of the Homes for All Coalition. And I just wanted to thank the chair and members for the inclusion of the $1 million for the Homework Starts with Home program, which the committee has been, you know, strong advocates of for many years. So we were very pleased to see that. Affordable housing was a really big issue heading into the session, and despite the fact that we love this $1 million that we were able to receive, it's going to remain a huge issue for many communities around the state. So we hope that the support we've seen in the committee extends to the capital investment bonding request that Homes for All has this session, and we also look forward to continue to work with everyone next session for bold and robust solutions for the affordable housing issues we see in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. And let's hope this is the floor for this and we can add some to it in conference. So thank you. On deck is Heather Corcoran. Oh, okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Charlie Vanderetti for Metro Cities, which represents the shared interests of cities across the seven-county metropolitan region. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today. Last year, Metro Cities supported Representative Howe's efforts to restore funding for the Minnesota Investment Fund and Job Creation Fund. Under his leadership and with the committee's support, city economic development officials and businesses recognized these state investments as a sign that Minnesota was open for business. Every day, cities work in partnership with local business owners who are expanding and working with those who wish to establish new businesses in Minnesota. We are concerned that the cuts in this bill could halt this growth. Even with current unemployment rate, Minnesota should still be encouraging business expansion and new business investments in the state. We heard testimony this year touting how MIF has helped businesses grow, and members of this committee said the availability of MIF funding and the state's flexibility in those programs allowed the state to support those private investments and economic growth. Metro Cities appreciates the concern raised by the OLA program evaluation. We've committed to the chair that our cities will look at how the two primary economic development programs can be improved from the city perspective and how DEED can better work with cities on technical assistance. We feel that these administrative changes are a productive response to the OLA's concerns as they will improve the programs and preserve program funding. With regard to local control, Metro Cities is supportive of policies that respect local decision-making and local governance and opposes efforts by the legislature to interfere with local decision-making authority. We're concerned with the provision to repeal Minnesota Statutes 471-9996 sub 2, which provides an exception to the prohibition on rent control for local units of government with the power to adopt an ordinance to control rents if the ordinance is approved by voters in a general election. Finally, Mr. Chair, it is our understanding there is an amendment to remove Article Sections 1 and 2 from the bill. Metro Cities would support that amendment and oppose these provisions as they preempt local decision-making authority and fee setting. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Heather Corcoran.
Mr. Chair, are we allowing questions of testimony?
For you, Representative Dabney. Yes, Representative Dabney.
This is my one time to use the ticket. The deed.
today announced that we're seeing, according to the Star Tribune, a continuing slowdown in job growth in Minnesota the last several months, and that unemployment within our communities of color still remains meaningfully higher than it does within the white community. Can you speak to how your concerns do or do not respond to slowing job growth and differential unemployment in different communities?
To the testifier.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, our cities are supportive of economic development across the full range of the spectrum. So when they look at businesses that are, A, looking to expand in their communities or new businesses looking to open up shop in their communities, they have a toolbox, whether it's local funding, whether it's regulations, whether it's state funding, and try and find the best package to meet the needs of businesses looking to open up in their community. And so in regard to whatever the local needs are, cities are looking to respond to that. I know that unemployment concerns are high across different parts of the state, and so I know that cities want to make sure that they have jobs for workers and residents in their communities.
All right. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as many people who have been on the committee know, I continually tell members that that are affected by these bills should come to the table and express their thoughts and not just come into an individual legislator's office and say, tell them how disappointed they are in the bill, but not come forward. I want to thank the two letters that I think all of us got. I think one was from Cottage Grove and one was from Maple Grove. Yeah, and I got a couple other phone calls today. So I suspect those are members of your organization, so I want to thank them for actually coming forth and saying how much they use the programs that are in place and are wanting to not cut these particular programs, which you are doing in this bill, Mr. Chair. So not even a question, just a comment.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, sir. Ms. Corcoran? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Heather Corcoran. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, a statewide association of over 830 cities from around the state. I'm testifying tonight in opposition to a provision in the DE amendment of House File 4289. The provision is found on lines 87.1 to 87.2 that Mr. Vandarotti referenced as well. This repeals the Minnesota Statute 471.9996, Subdivision 2, the exception to the prohibition on rent control for local units of government, with the power to adopt an ordinance to control rents if the ordinance is approved by voters in a general election. We are not aware of any cities that are currently working towards efforts using the exemption in Subdivision 2. However, the League sees this provision in the bill as one of the more than 50 examples this session that interfere with local decision-making authority. Over 120 cities from around the state have passed resolutions stating support for local decision-making authority and opposing legislation that removes the ability for local elected officials to respond to the health, safety, and welfare needs of their businesses and constituents. We respectfully encourage you to remove this provision from the bill.
Thank you. Is Mr. Kunkel here yet? No? All right. So that's the list of final testifiers who have signed up in advance. Are there any additional members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Oh, look who's came in right on time. Hey, don't worry, Mr. Kunkel. No one noticed you're late. I want to get you some time to situate it before you introduce yourself. Would it be possible for you, do you have the language of the bill in front of you so you can kind of cover some of the sections in there? I know you're on the spot. You don't have to. I just want to ask you if you...
Yeah, no, I don't have the copy of the DE in front of me right now. I can certainly speak to most of the provisions just off the top of my head also. Okay. I didn't know you wanted me to walk through the actual provisions as well, which I'm happy to do.
Okay, if you... we can't compel testimony, but it would just be helpful. I don't know, I guess maybe I can compel. Sure. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Chris Kunkel. I'm with Apex Clean Energy. Apex is a developer of utility-scale wind and solar projects across the country. We have a development pipeline of over 13 gigawatts throughout the country, making Apex an industry leader.
Today I'd like to testify, or this evening I'd like to testify in support of a couple of provisions that are included in the omnibus bill that you all are considering, that we believe would improve and streamline the permitting process for wind and solar facilities here in Minnesota. We believe these provisions build on the legislature's prior efforts to improve the regulatory climate in Minnesota and recognize the changing dynamics in the energy marketplace. We believe that these provisions will result in lower project costs and will make Minnesota a more attractive state for our industry. As you all are very well aware, we participate in a regional energy marketplace, and there are, for a company like ours, there are numerous considerations that we make when deciding where our company will invest our resources to develop and construct energy projects. And one of them is the anticipated permitting timeline in that state. By bringing Minnesota in line with neighboring states with regard to permitting timelines, we believe it will ensure that the state is on a level playing field. Neighboring states like North Dakota and South Dakota, to permit a wind project takes 6 months start to finish. In Iowa, it can even be a little bit less than that. Here in Minnesota, this process can take 9 months or longer. At a time when our customers, our off-takers, are demanding low-cost clean energy to be delivered as soon as possible, this is a very important consideration we make when determining where to build these projects. The intent of these provisions, which again I can walk through in more detail in a moment, is to reduce the permitting timeline for wind and solar projects to 6 months without limiting opportunities for vital public input. So I can just speak to again a couple of these provisions, and some of this may sound familiar to all of you. We discussed this in some detail in this committee last year as well. So the first provision is on 42-11, I believe, which is the list of exemptions from the Certificate of Need. In statute today, there are a number of exemptions, as you can see, that relate to wind and solar projects. What this legislation would do would be to provide a complete exemption for these renewable energy projects, again, with the goal of getting the timeline to get the site permit. You have to get a Certificate of Need and a site permit to get that site permit down to 6 months. There is another, let's see.
And Mr. Kugel, I realize I kind of surprised you.
Yeah, no.
So if you just want to take some time to review the bill, we'll wrap up some of the public testimony, and you can just kind of highlight those items at your leisure, and maybe come back if you wish to.
Yeah, just two other things I want to mention. There's two spots in here where we're changing timelines for extensions that the PUC can have for a couple different provisions from 3 months down to 30 days. And then there's another provision that would modify the definition of a large wind energy system to include the transmission line that is required to connect that LWEX, that large wind energy conversion system, to the grid. The reason that's important, there's a couple. Most importantly, the permitting a transmission line, a large high voltage line, if it's of a high enough voltage and it's of a certain length, it takes a full year. So if we're building a wind farm and we need to, which is a 6 month process, to get that transmission line could take a year. So there's a mismatch in terms of the timelines that we're looking at in order to interconnect certain wind facilities. So the intent of modifying that definition is to ensure that it's all considered in one permit at the Public Utilities Commission, both the wind project and the transmission line itself.
Mr. Kugel, and I know this is based off your recollection, I know a lot of this language is contained in last year's omnibus bill. There are a couple changes. Are you familiar enough to know what those tweaks were, so we're not kind of, I mean, some of this is re-educating members on what was in the bill last year.
Sure, yeah. So there's one provision, and again, I'm not an expert on this necessarily, but that relates to repowering. 2 or 3 years ago, the legislature included as an exemption from the Certificate of Need repowering projects or retrofit projects where you take an older wind farm and you're investing and modifying it to include new technologies, things like that, to sort of bring it up to date. And we wanted to ensure that you wouldn't have to go through and obtain a new site permit or something like that from the PUC in order to do this. My understanding is this is more of a technical fix than anything to ensure that if, you know, you're going to take a 100-megawatt project and retrofit it with some newer blades or something like that, and it were to increase to 105 megawatts, for example, or 125 megawatts, that it would still fall within this the certificate of need exemption. It's still all consistent with your other interconnection agreements, whether that be with the utility or with the regional grid operator, MISO.
And again, thank you for your testimony. Do you mind taking a couple member questions?
Yeah, okay.
So Representative Scott and then Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there was a colleague that served when I first arrived here at the legislature, and one of the questions that she was famous for asking was, when someone was asking for an exemption or whatever, she'd say, "What makes you so special?" And so I'm asking that question: what makes you so special that you should get these carve-outs for certificate of need and so forth? And particularly given the controversy over the siting of some of these wind farms with the people that live in proximity to them and are opposed to them for health reasons and other reasons. So if you could take a stab at that, what makes you so special?
And Mr. Conko, when she says you, she doesn't mean, she knows you personally are exceptionally.
Yes. The wind industry.
I think she's referring to the yes. policy provisions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott.
Because you are special.
Thank you.
We're all special.
We're not going to vote on that, though. We are not going to vote on that issue. So, Mr. Conko.
No, I want a trophy then.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, a couple of points there. So first, as you can see from the bill, there are already a number of exemptions in statute to the certificate of need. Among them is if the project is intended to meet the state's renewable energy standard, it is exempt from the certificate of need process. If a utility in procuring that wind project goes through a competitive procurement process, it can be exempt from the certificate of need. If the project is being built in Minnesota but not being sold to a Minnesota utility, if it's just a merchant plant, maybe it's being sold to a corporate customer or something like that, that is also exempt. So what we're looking at, what's not exempt right now, would be projects that are designed to be sold to a utility that are above and beyond that utility's obligations under the renewable energy standard. So as the state is meeting its renewable energy standard obligations, we believe there's going to continue to be wind projects and solar projects built that go beyond a utility's obligations to comply with that policy. And those projects, without a change in the law, would need to obtain a certificate of need. So that's one piece. The second, with regard to the siting, which I think is a great point, as I mentioned earlier, in order to build an electric generating facility in the state, you need to obtain a certificate of need as well as a site permit for that facility. And the site permit side, which we're not suggesting to modify other than the transmission line piece I discussed earlier, you still need to go through the route. That's where you handle the routing and siting process, and that's where public input is gathered on the location of the turbines, on the environmental impacts, things like that. Stakeholders can weigh in at that point in time. The certificate of need, I don't fully understand, and I don't want to bore you with sort of how that statute came to be, but it wasn't really with the intent of independent power producer companies like us. It was more designed to ensure that utilities, regulated utilities, are not overbuilding. So,
Mr. Conkle, if utility X goes out and they build a plant that's not needed and there was no certificate of need, the ratepayers would pay for that, correct? In this situation, if a developer was to go out and build a wind farm and assume that it was outside the RES and it didn't have the certificate of need as is proposed in this legislation, and they didn't sell the energy, if there was no one there to buy it, would the ratepayers still have to pay for it?
They would not. We do not have ratepayers in the state of Minnesota. Our shareholders would bear the cost of that.
So,
and I might lose my job.
Yeah. Well, so presumably, you don't build stuff unless you've got an agreement to sell it to somebody. And so the fact that there is a private contract existing, we're talking about outside the renewable energy standard, the fact that there's a private contract existing kind of is demonstration of the certificate of need.
That's correct. And one other point I'd make is the certificate of need statute or to obtain a certificate of need is a 12-month process. And so getting back to that six-month, trying to get the timeline down to that to match with neighboring states with whom we're competing, that's part of the idea as well.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That'll do for now.
Okay, thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I think in a courtroom that would have been called asking a leading question. just to have you know that. I have a question. I have two questions here. When you change the language on change and add language on page 42, you talked about a little bit about changing the nameplate capacity. You said if it was 100, they could change it to 105 mm-hmm. or 125. How much could they change the nameplate capacity before they would have to go back to the PUC?
Mr. Kunkel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that's a good question, and frankly, I don't know that I know the exact answer to that, other than to say that you would still have some sort of cap on the increase based on either your PPA with the utility or with your general interconnection agreements in terms of how many megawatts you can inject into the system at that particular location without, you know, creating other without affecting the system elsewhere.
Well,
Representative
thank you.
Mahoney.
And maybe we should look at putting a percentage of increase before you go back to that. But it's obvious you don't have, and I'm not faulting you for not having that answer at right then and there. But then when you talk about changing the permitting process, you're giving the public less time for input from 1 year down to 6 months. Is that correct?
Mr. Kunkel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, my understanding is that the vast majority, not all, of the public input is typically gathered during the site permitting process. And that's always been a six-month process. That's not proposed to be changed. Also, again, most of the projects in the states, to my knowledge, have been built without needing a certificate of need, either because they were designed to meet the renewable energy standard or they were built out as part of a utilities competitive procurement process, both of which would make that project exempt from the CON. I don't know that I would look at it as really limiting the public input. I think we're trying to focus the attention just on the site permitting process.
Well, Mr. Chair, when you I don't know how you can actually say that when you change the time from 1 year to 6 months. I'm not entirely opposed to that because I do believe sometimes the PUC on some particular issues moves relatively slowly. I won't go into which particular item I'm talking about. But I do have concerns when you shorten the time frame, as Representative Scott referred to, on power lines and a variety of other things. So I just want people to understand that if we're voting for this bill, we're shortening the length of time that someone has to bring to the table a concern about a high-voltage power line across their farm country or over their playground or wherever. So, and I'm right in that particular instance, if we vote for this bill, we're shortening that time frame that they have to bring concerns by 6 months.
Mr. Kunkel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney. So to the transmission line piece, because we're not a utility, we don't have eminent domain authority. So the transmission line, in changing the definition to include that transmission line, it's pretty narrow insofar as it's only a line to connect our project with the system, and we would have to go out and obtain all of those easements voluntarily and compensate landowners accordingly. But again, getting back to the site permitting process, that's always been 6 months. That's where you discuss the human and environmental impacts of the project, and we're not proposing to change that timeline.
Representative Mahoney.
No, I'm good.
So, Representative McGinnis, you're going to get the last question, then we're going to get back to this taking public testimony. We'll have questions be at the completion of public testimony. So, Representative McGinnis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just listening to your testimony, and you're talking about how other states do so well, and how I think you've talked about Iowa and South Dakota are such good states. I'm going to ask Representative Scott's question, which I liked, in reverse. What makes us so special?
Mr. Kunkel.
I'm not sure I follow Mr. Chair, Representative McGinnis.
Representative McGinnis.
Why are you here? Why aren't you concentrating in the states that you like so much?
Mr. Kunkel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bouguinius, there's a whole host of reasons that we want to do business in the state of Minnesota. The state has a fantastic wind resource. The state has access to transmission, which is a hindrance in the Dakotas right now. There's so much wind being proposed that it's just tough to get onto the lines that exist and can't build transmission fast enough. There's already a lot of wind in the ground in Minnesota, and so you have a lot of supportive communities that are comfortable with this and want to see more. If hypothetically Xcel goes out for an RFP to seek wind, they can, as they've done in the past, obtain procure projects located in any number of states, North and South Dakota, Iowa, here in Minnesota. And so, again, when we're trying to respond to those RFPs, we might have a pipeline with a project in each one of those states, and we're trying to figure out, among all the different things, wind resource, transmission risk and availability, permitting timeline, all these different things, we're putting forward the best projects. And the permitting timeline is just one of the many things that we consider when we're deciding how and when to invest capital in different states.
Representative Guinness?
Well, I would just observe that there are a number of states that have great wind. We're only ninth in the nation. So the thing that maybe makes us special is we do have these transmission lines. So I think maybe that makes us so special, actually, that Representative Mahoney's question or observation is a good one. Minnesota does have some advantages, and maybe we have, from your point of view, some disadvantages. But it seems to me our advantages right now outweigh our disadvantages from your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Kunkel, for your testimony, and you'll be around for questions later.
I will.
Thank you.
I promise.
Thank you. So we've been notified there is an additional testifier, a Rick Evans from Xcel Energy. And are there other additional members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? If you just want to, we'll just take you first in order, or whoever knocks anyone down and runs down to the front closest. So, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. I want to take just a brief moment, first of all, to answer some questions that were raised in earlier discussions on this bill. And frankly, on the other nuclear bill, just very quickly, so that information is provided to members. I believe Representative Wagenius had asked me whether we agreed with the $1.4 billion estimate that the Chamber of Commerce was using for the ongoing use of the nuclear plants. $1.4 billion is an answer that we gave in an earlier response to an earlier question from the Department of Commerce for the capital investments in the two nuclear plants through the end of their license. We will file updated information when we file our resource plan in February, and our expectation is it will be a lower amount. So I would think you'd ask me for a range, and I think $1.2 to $1.4 billion would probably, at this point in the analysis, be the right range. I believe you also asked me, Representative Guinness also asked me what that money would be used for, and those would be that's an expectation of the capital investments to keep the plants operating through the end of their license. I think the question went to what would happen then after the plants closed, and that $1.2 to $1.4 billion would not be for the cost of decommissioning the plants. That's an estimate of the capital investments to keep the plants running through the end of their license. After the plants close, something called the Nuclear Decommissioning Trust becomes the source of fund. That's a fund that is regulated both by state and federal regulators, and it's kind of like a pension fund. You have to keep an eye on it and make sure you're keeping up with what you think the costs are going to be. And that's something that happens at both at the state and federal level as they watch the decommissioning fund to ensure that it's got it will have enough money at the end of the plant's life to do the job that needs to be done at that point. On the bill in front of the committee, I believe Representative Mahoney asked me about the expenses for Yucca Mountain, and I think I said I wasn't sure that we had given any money, and I was wrong by a fairly large factor. So all of the nuclear industry, nuclear utilities pay and have since very early on a 0.001 cents per kilowatt hour fee to the nuclear waste fund, which is what was used to construct Yucca Mountain. The total contribution from our utility was $940 million over that period of time. In 2014, someone in Washington, D.C. finally woke up and said, why are we continuing to collect this money for something that's not going anywhere? And so we have not made payments since 2014. since 2014. We could only hope, yes. And that money that was paid has not been recovered as a part of the lawsuits that I made reference to where we recovered damages for the federal government's failure to live up to its obligations. And then finally, in terms of answering questions, two what they call consolidated interim storage facilities, CIS, one is located in Texas. It's being proposed by a company called Waste Control Specialists. If you look at WCSTexas.com, you will get a lot of information not only about their current activities but also their proposed CIS facility for consolidated minimum storage. Representative Clark asked me, it is on land that is owned currently by WCS where they do low-level nuclear waste storage currently. It is not tribal land. It is privately owned land. I was not able to find much information about the local government support, which I believe Representative Wagenius asked me about. However, the other facility, which is being constructed by Holtec International, by Holtec International in New Mexico. If you look at HoltecInternational.com, you will find out some more information about that company as well as its proposal for the CIS. Holtec is working in collaboration with an organization called Eddie Lee Energy Alliance, LLC, which is a consortium of small towns and counties, one of them called Eddie County and one of them called Lee County, L-E-A County in New Mexico, who are joining with Holtec in the application for the CIS facility. As a way to spur economic development in that region. And they also have a very long website name. I think I provided this to the committee administrator, so he has some of these notes. And you can look at the Eddie Lee Energy Alliance.com website and see some information about the local support. And then finally, I just very briefly, because I think I neglected to do this the other day, want to add XL Energy's support for this bill. We think this is really making some tremendous strides in both lowering costs for our customers as well as pursuing some important energy policy. We particularly are excited about the opportunity of helping the Prairie Island Indian community become a net zero community using RDA funds. We think that's a very good use of the RDA funds. We particularly like the $2 million that are being granted to pursue the projects I just spoke about, which is the CIS projects and the transportation study. And we are very excited about the possibility presented in this bill of lowering our customers' contributions to the Renewable Development Fund. We think it's about time that we do that. It will still be collecting a fairly significant amount of money over the life of the plants, but going from what this year would be $32.5 million, or I should say next year would be $32.5 million, to $16 million is a significant savings for our $20 million, pardon me, Mr. Chair. I'm confusing the two bodies. I don't know how I can do that. But
I don't either.
Pardon me?
I said, I don't either.
So to reduce it to $20 million is a significant savings for our customers over the life of these plants. And so we really appreciate that, and we think it's an excellent package, and we support it.
Thank you.
I will be around to answer questions later if necessary.
Thank you. The next public testifier, please come forward. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tyrone Terrell. I'm with the Community Ambassadors Initiative. Joe Franklin, our director, cannot be here today. He had surgery this week, and so he's recovering. But just want to come here today and say thank you to you for including us in the bill. We look forward to putting 30-plus young people to work, and as well keeping our 30 ambassadors on the streets in downtown St. Paul, reducing crime at a 64% rate when they're working. So we're just excited for the opportunity. I just want to say thank you.
Thank you. The next testifier, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tammy Chong, and I'm the Director of Intergovernmental Affairs for the City of St. Paul. First, I wanted to thank you on behalf of the city for including multiple programs and projects that benefit our city and our residents. In particular, I want to thank you for including the Emerald Ash Borer Removal Program in your bill. This is a significant investment, and we appreciate it. Additionally, our office has submitted a letter expressing some concerns we have regarding the tipped employee provisions. And our office, especially our Deputy Mayor Jamie Tincher, looks forward to working with your office to address some of these concerns. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next testifier, please come forward. Welcome.
Good evening. My name is Matt Brown. I'm here this evening on behalf of the Economic Development Association of Minnesota, or EDEM. I work as Economic Development Coordinator for the City of Coon Rapids. Just wanted to express some concern about the proposed funding changes to deed programs, Minnesota Investment Fund and Job Creation Fund, that are proposed in the current version of the bill. I'll say in Coon Rapids, in my experience over the last several years, I've been able to utilize those funds on three occasions, including on an expansion of a local injection molding business, a firm working on a cancer vaccine, also a contract manufacturer for the medical device industry. All three of those projects resulted in addition of high-paying jobs that continue to exist in the region. And I'll say that the state funds were really critical to sealing the deal on all of those projects. So I will say maintaining consistent funding of those programs is really important. I know I've been in the position of working with a business, and years ago when the programs weren't funded as consistently, having to tell them, you know, we have to wait around to see whether or not the legislature will fund those programs. And I think that doesn't necessarily reflect well on the state of Minnesota when we don't have that consistent source and consistent resources for businesses to use when they're coming into the region or expanding. And I'll say our organization, EDEM, has members from all over the state. We're about 50% metro, 50% rural, also about 50% public sector, 50% private sector, and pretty universally among our membership, they will tell us that consistent funding of those programs is important. So I'll say, too, Some of those changes, the reduction in funding is pretty significant in that I know that DEED and others have projects in the pipeline right now that would really deplete what would be available. So we have some concerns about that. So wanted to thank you for the committee's past support, certainly last year, in funding those programs, and wanted to urge you to continue to fund those at the levels that were budgeted last year. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney, we're going to wrap up public testimony, then we'll do questions, okay?
No, I just got one quick question for him.
I know. It's going to wrap up the
I'll
public
be quick.
Representative
I'll be
Mahoney.
Quick. Do all of your members use the jobs, the JCP and the MIF program? And did you know that most of the money now is earmarked for projects?
To the testifier.
Two questions, I guess. So.
I was aware of the change in specifying those projects. I will say, you know, not necessarily all of our members, but certainly many of our members from all over the state at the local level have used those programs over the years.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any additional members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Come on down. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Scott Marquardt. I'm with Southwest Initiative Foundation based in Hutchinson. We serve a region covering 18 counties and two Native nations. And I would also like to say thank you for placing child care funding in the bill, specifically referring to the text starting on line 20.17. We are beyond grateful that there is child care funding in the bill. As I've indicated before this committee, it is the fastest growing and urgent economic development issue in our region, significantly impacting our businesses' ability to attract and retain talent that they need going forward. It's weighing on our organization, our board, and our companies heavily in our communities, and it will continue to. I do have a concern or an ask I'd like to raise, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, regarding line 21.6. There's a clause in there, at least half of the money in fiscal year 19 is reserved for new grant recipients. We are hopeful that the intent of that clause is referring to putting capital into new projects, but as written, as is, we are concerned that this would have an unintended impact on the competitiveness of new projects contained in proposals from regional organizations and intermediaries like us. Who would be the legal grantee of record. In the past, our organization and our partner organizations have applied on behalf of child care center project expansions and startups, entrepreneurs, and then re-granted them to the projects. In 2018, I relooked at the press release from DEED. Five of the seven grantees of record were regional organizations like us. And over time, we have successfully received funding and placed capital into seven unique startup or expansion projects and two professional development opportunities, because we feel we can add value for some of these center directors and startup entrepreneurs who have 100 things on their plate going right now and may not have the capacity to do it. So we respectfully ask that that clause on line 21.6, if not struck, is revised to focus on the end user or the project itself, not the applicant or grantee of record. We want to continue as a regional organization to add value to the centers and to the projects and to bring DEED great applications that we feel have regional impact and regional significance so that we can continue to build the capacity in our region. Thank you.
Thank you. And as we go forward, not tomorrow, but as we go forward, let's stay in touch about that to make sure that the intent is what we meant, not what you just said. So
thank you.
Our next testifier, please come forward. Seeing no, all right, well. Mr. Cardinal, are you up to testify? No, there's, okay. Seeing no additional public testimony, that will complete the public comment portion of this. Are there any questions or comments from members of the committee for the testifiers we heard this evening? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Yes,
Representative Guinness, if you can grab your mic, please. Thank you.
Mr. Evans did send us a letter and testify. I'm just getting out the sheet paper that he sent.
Would you like Mr. Evans to come down? Or Mr. Evans, come on down. He'll be here soon, Representative Guinness. He doesn't move as fast as it used to. If you could reintroduce yourself to the tape, please.
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy.
Representative Lagunas.
Well, thank you, Mr. Evans. When I asked the question that you answered on line two, I was trying to get at the question of if we put additional casks on Prairie Island or Monticello, will we incur additional expenses beyond the 1.2 to 1.4? And your answer was that once the plants are decommissioned, the cost of maintaining the spent fuel will be paid out of the nuclear decommissioning trust fund. The implication there is that that's a closed trust fund and doesn't need any more money. Am I reading that right?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lagunas, as the first part of your question, so the schedule for placing additional casks out in storage at the plant is a known quantity. I mean, we know by the time we get to the end of license how many plants, or excuse me, how many casks will be placed out there. So that's built into the 1.2 to 1.4 million is the cost of placing and maintaining those casks. The Nuclear Decommissioning Trust, you know, I think I could compare most closely to something like a pension fund, which it's, the money is actually deposited, it's invested, it earns, it loses, and that sort of thing. And so we are under the under kind of the thumb of the both state and federal regulators who work with us, first of all, to figure out how much is it going to cost to decommission the plant, and then work with us to figure out how much money we should be putting in the Nuclear Decommissioning Trust. So it's not a fixed amount or we get to $87 million and we're done or anything like that. It is an ongoing process reviewed quite regularly to see how are we doing in collecting money and how are we, what do we think the costs are going to be that we'll need to have at the end of the plant's life. And again, highly regulated by both state and federal regulators.
Representative Guineas.
So it's possible that the Nuclear Decommissioning Trust Fund will be asking for more money. If it's like a pension fund, that is what happens. So then my assumption that because there will be new casks put on Prairie Island and Monticello, there will be more demand on the fund. And so the question I was just trying to get at, and I think I know the answer now, is yes, there will be obligations beyond the $1.2 to $1.4 billion range as a cost of having these plants operate to the end of their life. Did I get that right?
Mr. Evans.
Unfortunately, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to have to go back and make sure I understand. I believe that the deposits, any further deposits in the Nuclear Decommissioning Trust would be figured into the cost of operating the plants because we need to make those payments in order to operate the plants and be compliant with our regulators. So, but I'm not absolutely positive about that, whether and again, the 1.4 million, 1.2 to 1.4 million includes capital investments in the plant. It does not include operations and maintenance of the plant, and I'm not sure exactly where NDT deposits would fall in that range. So I'm going to have to go back and double check my information. But you know, when we talk about both operating the plants through the end of their life as well as what's going to have to happen afterwards, we work very closely with our regulators to make sure that there is sufficient money to do all of those things. Obviously, if we were not to make investments in the plant that were required by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or anyone else, we couldn't operate the plant. So that's what we try to predict as we lay these budgets out.
Representative Guineas.
Thank you. I mean, there is this question here, and we don't know the answer. So I look forward to knowing whether that is that additional cost will be there. Generally, when we have waste out that's going to take maintenance forever, we're going to have to pay more for it. I just want to know if that's already been paid, and it sounds like there's no cap because this is a pension-type fund, and pension-type funds
need additional money coming in. We all know that over here, don't we? I can ask when we're going to pass the pension bill, but I won't.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, so if the all-in cost, it sounds like you had said capital investment, but I think you mean operations and capital and everything to keep the two facilities going and three reactors, it was between $1.4 billion and $1.2 billion. But when you look at how many reactor years there's left, so there's 43 reactor years because Monticello has 12 and the two at Prairie Island are 15 and 16, so that's 43 reactor years. And when you calculate backwards, the range is actually $32.5 million to $27.9 million per reactor per year. So, and you had just testified to the fact that just in this year or next year, it's $32 million going into the RDA, right? So $32 million is going into the RDA, and over the next, over the lifetime, what's left of the lifetime of the two facilities, it's between, your range that you had just given us was between 32.5 and 29 or 27.9 million per reactor per year. So to me, I was just looking at those numbers going, wow, it's like we're putting $32 million per year into the RDA, and that's like a third of the cost going forward, maybe even a little bit more if it's, you know, that's a lot of money going into the RDA. And that makes Representative Barr's bill really impactful because, you know, you're slowly dropping off how much you're putting into the RDA because it's just another tax on a ratepayer. It's a very, very, very expensive tax on a ratepayer. It's a third of the cost of the nuclear plants. So thank you for bringing those numbers forward. If I'm, you know, if I'm wrong, please correct me, but that's the back of the napkin that I just did from the numbers you just gave us.
So, Mr. Evans, we're not really in the debating the bill or maybe even debating a potential amendment that's going to be coming forward tomorrow. So thank you for answering our questions. Are there any other questions for members of the committee for our public testifiers? All right, seeing none, this will complete the public testimony and the agenda. Just a reminder for tomorrow, we are meeting at 10 a.m. in room 200. The amendments for the bill have all been publicly posted. Representative Mahoney, if there needs to be more time for DFL to research amendments, Mr. Galan, if we need more time to research amendments, just let the chair know, be in contact with me. But that should complete our agenda. Any other questions from members of the committee? With that, we